Okay, we're going to begin here at the bottom of Kuf Chaf Amud Bet, just to review that Breita that was brought for Beit Shammai, because Beit Shammai does not have the Gzera Shava of Zeh Adavar. So then how do they know that Hatarat Nedarim can be done by Shlosha Hejutot? So the Gemara says that they use this Breita, Minav Lehu. Where do they know that Shlosha Hejutot are sufficient for Hatarat Nedarim? Nafalku Minitanya. They learn it out of the following Breita. By Deber Moshe Modei Hashem El Bnei Yisrael. So that is part of the Parshat Moadot in Sefer Vayikra and Parshat Emor. So now, based on that pasuk, we say Rabbi Yossi Omer Modei Hashem Ne'emru Shabbat Breishit Lo Ne'emra. Modei Hashem were mentioned, but Shabbat Breishit is not. Ben Azai Omer Modei Hashem Ne'emru Hafarat Nedarim Lo Ne'emra. Modei Hashem are included in this. But Hafarat Nedarim is not included in this. So now the Rabbi Yossi Bar Natan Gomir La, Laha Matnita, he learned this Breita, he knew this Breita, Velo Yodole Leperushak, but he didn't understand it, he didn't know how to explain it. It's a difficult Breita to understand. Azal Batre the Rav Sheshet, the Narada. So he followed after Rav Sheshet to go to Narada to get clarification on the Breita, Velo Ashkechei, and he wasn't there. Azal Batre the Mechuza, then he traveled further on to Mechuza, Ashkechei, and he caught up with him. Amalei, my Mo'adei Hashem Nemru Shabbat Breishit Lo Nemra. Please explain to me what is meant here in the Breita that Mo'adei Hashem are mentioned, Shabbat Breishit Lo Nemra. On the other hand, the Shabbat Breishit is not mentioned. The problem is that in the beginning of Parshat Mo'adot in Emor, it says, Ve'idaber Hashem Moshe Lemor, Daber Ol B'nei Yisrael V'amarta Lehem Mo'adei Hashem Asher Tikruo Otam Mikra'i Kodesh, Elohim Moadai. And then it says, Sheishit Yamim, Tatsem Melacha, V'yom Eshvi Shabbat Shabbaton, Mikra Kodesh, Kol Melacha Lo Tasu, Shabbati L'Hashem B'chol Moshvotechem. So you have Shabbat mentioned in the Parashat Moadot. And then it continues on, Elohim Moadai Hashem, Mikra Kodesh, Asher Tikru Otam B'Moadam, and then leads into Pesach. So Shabbat is mentioned in the Parashat Moadot. So why are you saying that this references to Moadai Hashem, and doesn't reference to Shabbat Breishit? Amalei says this is the meaning. Mo'adei Hashem tzrichim kiddush beitin. Shabbat Breishit eina tzricha kiddush beitin. When it comes to the Mo'adei Hashem, they require the kiddush of beitin. In order to be sanctified, they require a beitin. Shabbat Breishit, as the Rashbam notes, is to distinguish it from other Shabbatot. You have Shemitah, which is Shabbat Aretz. You have the other Chagim or Mo'adim that are called Shabbat, or Yom Kippur that's called Shabbat Shabbaton. Shabbat Breishit is to distinguish it from those other Shabbatot, but Shabbat Breishit ain't a tzricha kiddush beitin. Shabbat Breishit is what we call kiddusha v'kaima. Its kiddusha exists irrespective of any outside action by beitin or any kviut ayidei adam. So as the Rashbam notes over here, we are not actually mikadesh de moadim, but we do it through kiddush hachodesh. Once you are mikadesh rosh chodesh, then Rosh Chodesh will define which days are going to be the Moadot because of the fact that if you are koveya when Rosh Chodesh Nisan is, then you will know when Tedvav Nisan is and when Pesach Chag HaMatzot is going to fall out. So it's a derivative of the Kiddush HaChodesh. And in an instance where we're Mekadesh HaPi HaRi'iyah, then Beitin is the one who's koveya the Kiddush HaChodesh. So that means that when the Edim come and they say we saw the new moon, then Beit Din responds by saying Mikudash, and all the people that are present there say Mikudash, Mikudash, and that establishes that day as Rosh Chodesh, which will then define the days of the month as far as when the holidays are going to fall out. Now, that is true when it comes to a Chaser month. When it comes to a month that is Malay, then it can't go beyond that point. By definition, a chodesh can't be more than 30 days. It can be 29 or it can be 30. So if you're a mekadeshit on the 29th day, Beit Din takes an active role in the kedusha or being makdish the chodesh. In the case where it's a malay, then by definition that will be the length of the month, and Beit Din doesn't necessarily have to do anything. That happens to be a machloket rishonim, which is not necessarily relevant to our topic today, but just to note that the rishonim argue about whether when it turns out on the 30th, it happens automatically, Or is there still a need for Beit Din to say Mikudash on the 30th, even though it happens by itself? The nafkamina between them is when you forget to say Yalev Yavo. On Rosh Chodesh, if you forget to add in Yalev Yavo in Shmon Esrei, the loch is that at night you do not have to go back. During the day you have to go back. The reason being is that Ein Beit Din Mikadashin et HaChodesh Balayla. There is no Kiddush HaChodesh at night. Since there's no Kiddush HaChodesh at night, if you miss Yalev Yavo, we don't see that as a big infringement or a problem in your Shmon Esrei. You miss it during the day when Beit Din can be Mikadesh it, then that's a problem because that's when Rosh Chodesh would be. In a case where it's on the 30th, then that question would manifest itself in a difference halachically as to whether on a Chodesh that is Malay, on the night of the 30th, if you miss Yalev Yavo, do you have to repeat it? If you believe that Beit Din is still actively engaged or has a role in Mimikadesh the Chodesh, the answer would be yes, because Emikadeshin Balayla. If you think then it's Kitchev Akaimo, that it just automatically is Mikadesh itself, then it would be irrespective of whether Beit Din sat or not, then the night wouldn't be different from the day. It's automatically Rosh Chodesh. So that would be a nafkamina between those two opinions. It's a suffix bracha the hakel, so generally we are makil with regards to this. And when one day of Rosh Chodesh, then for sure we would say that when you miss Yalev Yavo, that's not a problem because in Beit Din would have to mikadesh it. When it's a 2-day Rosh Chodesh, that's much more questionable. On the first night, for sure, we would not make you go back. The question is on the second night, and because it's suffix bracha the hakel, generally, the Mishnah Berurah says that you wouldn't go back even on the second night if you missed Yalev Yavo. So now, that is in contrast to Shabbat. The question is, what was the Hava Mina by Shabbat? What exactly would you do by Shabbat in order to be Mikadesh the Shabbat? Shabbat is driven by a cycle of days, of 7 days. So that's what the Rashbam suggests, that you would have to count the days. You'd have to say, this today is Yom Rishon, today is Yom Sheni, and then you would reach Yom Shvi'i, and that would become Mikudash as Shabbat. So there'd be a requirement to enumerate the days of the week in order to get to the Kedusha of Shabbat. It's somewhat problematic because, unlike the Chodesh, where there is some flexibility, with regards to the cycling of the 7 days, it's automatic. Again, similar to the 30 days when the month is in Malay, but the 7 days, why would you need to count it? Because no matter what happens, the seventh day will always be the seventh day. You have no impact on the seventh day. You could answer that that cycling of 7 days would be Nikvayu de Beit Din. That might relate to a Gemara in Shabbat when someone is lost in the Midbar and they don't know what to do. So in that case, they begin counting 7 days and they keep every seventh day as Shabbat. There are other rules on the other days because it's a fake Shabbat on the other days because you don't know which one. But there's still this concept that you have to have a cycle of 7 days because of the Zecher of Shabbat. So maybe that's what it's referencing to. Anyway, it's interesting comparison. The Hava Mina, of course, is that Shabbat is included in Parshat HaMo'adot in Emor. And so the Hava Mina would be that Shabbat should be no different than all the other Mo'adot. The answer is Shabbat is distinguished. Now, you could have answered or you could have separated in Shabbat itself between the two aspects of Shabbat. Shabbat, as we say in Kiddush on Friday night, is Zecher L'Maseh Breshit and Zecher L'Tziat Mitzrayim. In its role as Zecher L'Maseh Breshit, that's part of the cycling of the 7 days. As its role as Zecher L'Tziat Mitzrayim, it's part of Parshat Mo'adot. And that's what we say there, that it's Tchila L'Mikra'i Kodesh. It's the first or the paradigm of the Mikra'i Kodesh because it's mentioned first in the Parsha of the Mo'adot in Emor. So you could have argued that Shabbat Breshit does not require Kiddush, but Shabbat as Zecher L'Tziat Mitzrayim would require Kiddush. And we do have a remnant of that, or a Zecher to that, which is, we say here that Shabbat is Kiddush V'Kayma. Shabbat exists as Kadosh, irrespective of the fact of Beit Din, or whether we're Mekadesh it. Nevertheless, we still say Kiddush, and we still are Mekadesh the Shabbat. So despite the fact that it's Kiddush V'Kayma, we still take an active role in being Mikadesh the Shabbat. So in some senses, maybe we are doing both aspects of that, which is that it is inherently Kadosh. But so our active engagement to be Mikadesh the Shabbat might have some aspect of that, of it being part of the Parshat HaMo'adot, Zecher L'Tziat Mitzrayim, even though it's not exactly similar to that which happens by the Mo'adot in terms of Kiddush HaChodesh, which is Koveya, the day. Nevertheless, there's still an aspect of being mekadesh the day, despite the fact that it's kidsha v'kaima. The answer given is that Mo'adei Hashem require kiddush, not Shabbat Breishit. And that's partly borne out by the parsha itself, which begins with the Berel B'nei Yisrael v'matalei Mo'adei Hashem sh'tekru otam mikrei kodesh, elei Mo'adei, mentions Shabbat. But then there's another opening pasuk, which is, right after it mentions Shabbat, it says, elei Mo'adei Hashem mikrei kodesh sh'tekru otam b'mo'adam. So it starts again. There's a new introduction, separating out Shabbat from Shar HaMo'adot. And in that way, Shabbat Breishit is different than Mo'adei Hashem. So that's the first explanation. Since it's written in Parshat HaMo'adot, I would have thought Tibai Kiddush Beitin Kimo'adot. It would require Kiddush Beitin like the Mo'adot. That's what we saw in the Rishbam, the suggestion about the counting of the 7 days. Kamash Malan, the conclusion is, no, Mo'adei Hashem only require Kiddush Beitin. The Shabbat does not require Kiddush Beitin. And Kiddush HaChodesh, which is what we're speaking about here in terms of Kiddush Beitin, is sourced from HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim, which was given to Moshe and Aaron, despite the fact that Moshe, of course, is a mumcha, and he could have done it himself. Hashem still required him and Aaron in order to do Kiddush HaChodesh. And we know that you can't have a Beit Din Shakul. From there, you end up with 3-4 Kiddush HaChodesh. So that's where we know that you have to have Kiddush Beit Din. That's also manifest, as the Gemara in Beitza says, in the way that we conclude the Brachot. On Shabbat, we say in Shmon Esrei Mekadesh HaShabbat. On the other hand, on the Mo'adot, we say Mekadesh Yisrael Ve'azmanim. Because there, Yisrael is Koveya Dizmanim, versus Shabbat, which is Kiddusha V'kaima. So then, my Mo'adei Hashem ne'emru, hafarat nedarim lo ne'emra. What is the second part of the Braita, which is the one that's relevant to us, which is how Beit Shammai learns out that you can have hafarat nedarim v'shloshei jutot. Mo'adei Hashem tzrichim mumchim. Mo'adei Hashem require mumchim, like we just said, from HaKodesh HaZelechem Rosh Kodeshim, Moshe and Aaron, who are mumchim, and you can't have a Beit Din Shakul, so that requires 3. Hafarat nedarim einat tzricha mumchim. On the other hand, Hafarat Nedarim, or Hatarat Nedarim in this case, does not require 3 mumchim. Where it says, V'aroshe Matot Ktiv. The Parshiyav Nedarim starts in Parshat Matot with Moshe speaking to the Roshei Matot. So it sounds like you do need somebody of significance there. So Amrav Chista, Amrav Yochanan, is what we quoted yesterday. We said yesterday, Hachanami, here's the place that they said it, which is V'yachid Mumcha. Moshe Matot teaches you that a Yachid Mumche is sufficient with regards to Hatarat Nedarim, or if you're going to have Hejotot, then you need Shlosha Hejotot. So this is the source for the fact that Beit Shammai says Shlosha Hejotot you can use by Hatarat Nedarim. They learn it out from the contrast of the Pasuk that says Mo'adei Hashem require Mumchim, but Hatarat Nedarim does not require Mumchim. And from there you learn that Shlosha Hejotot will work by Hatarat Nedarim. Like we mentioned yesterday, it's a machloket in the Rishonim. When we say Yachid Mumche, the Ramban is of the belief Yachid Mumche requires that it have smicha, which doesn't exist today, and that would be a problem for using the Yachid Mumche today. Other Rishonim, like the Rambam and other Rishonim, and the Rashbam said it yesterday, someone who is a Rav Gadol knows as well and was learned and is someone of stature, but it doesn't mean someone has smicha. So nafkamina is whether you can use a Yachid Mumche today. Because of the Ramban, we don't use a Yachid Mumche today. We only do it with Shlosha Hejutot, or even Shlosha Mumchim, if they would be classified as Mumchim for those Rishonim. Tzadan Otom. We have a Mishnah over there in Ta'anit. It's the last Mishnah in Ta'anit. We're going to bring it down because it has relevance to us in part. Amar Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, lo ayu yamim tovim l'Israel, k'chamishasar ba'av u'chiyom ha-kippurim. There were no better days or holidays or celebratory days for Israel like the 15th of Av and Yom Kippur. Sheben benot Yisrael yotzot b'klei lavan she'ulim. The daughters of Israel used to go out in their white linen clothing that was borrowed. Shelo levayesh et mishein lo. In order not to embarrass those that didn't have. Those that didn't have obviously had to borrow. But even those that had, meaning the Bat Melech, the Bat Kohen Gadol, they used to borrow from each other as well, in order that nobody should be embarrassed by the fact that they had to borrow. Similar to what Rabbi Gamliel established in terms of Tachrichim, that he put into place this Takanah when he was taken out, that he went out in simple Tachrichim, because not everybody could afford the funerals. So he made it, or he simplified the funerals, so that everybody, even the Nasi Shri Yisrael, if he's buried this way, then everybody can feel comfortable to be banging that way and would not embarrass anyone. And similar protocols that we have by the burying of individuals, we do things in order not to embarrass the individual, or because kavod mate, we have a standard that we do for everyone, even though it's not necessarily applicable to everyone. So similarly over here, even though not everybody had to borrow clothing, they all did, in order to make it comfortable for those who did need to borrow their clothing. Gemara says the obvious thing, Bishlama Yom HaKippurim, even though it's not so Bishlama, but Bishlama Yom HaKippurim, Yom Slicha Mechila, it is a day of forgiveness before Hashem. Yoshenitna Bo Luchot Achronot. It's the day on which we receive the second Luchot. So therefore, it's a day of celebration. It makes sense to be the happiest day of the year. There's two aspects. Again, the day that the Luchot HaShniot were given is a calculation that the Rashbam does. The Rashbam kind of just pushes through it. But when we learned this, it is a very difficult calculation. Because in order to get there, you need to have three sets of 40 days. That is, from the time of Mamad Har Sinai until Yudzayin B'Tammuz, you have to have 40 days. Because Moshe goes up to the mountain to receive the Luchot and comes down on the 17th of Tammuz and breaks the Luchot. That's one of the five things that we fast for on Yudzayin B'Tammuz. Then he needs to go back up to Har Sinai and descend again somewhere around Rosh Chodesh Elul, because that's why Rosh Chodesh Elul is the beginning of the Yemei Ratzon. Because that was the 40-day period where Moshe was begging for forgiveness over the Chet HaEgel. So the first 40 days is the Luchot Rishonot. Second set of 40 days is asking for forgiveness. And the last 40 days is the Luchot Achronot. So that's why they're known as the Yemei Ratzon, starting from Rosh Chodesh Elul and ending on Yom HaKippurim, when Moshe descends with the Luchot Achronot. And that's why Yom HaKippurim is a day of Slicha Mechila. Because the fact that Moshe came down with the Luchot Achronot, which is an indication of Hashem's forgiving of the Am and the replacement of the first Luchot that were broken, so the Brit Chadashah that is established with the Luchot Achronot, that happens on Yom HaKippurim, and that's what establishes Yom HaKippurim, is a Yom Slicha Mechila Lidorot. So you have three sets of 40 days. The problem is, very hard to get 120 days between Mamad Har Sinai and Yom HaKippurim without moving things around or fudging some numbers. So there is a machloket in the Rishonim as to how to get to that calculation. The Rashbam over here does it, and he kind of does some quick things over here that you don't even notice that he's adding in days to do it. But you have to either say that the months were chaser, malay at different points, even though it's not the way that our calendar works, or you have to come up with different explanations as to the days. Rashi, who brings the calculation similar to what the Rashbam brings over here, the Baal Tosafot over there, question that whole calculation, and they themselves come up with two other calculations or ways to calculate it. Again, it's very difficult to do, but that is the Masorah that we have, that Yudzayin B'Tammuz, the first Luchot are broken, that Yom HaKippurim, the second Luchot are brought down, starting from Rosh Chodesh Elul is Yemei HaRatzon. So you have to work it out that it would fall out in that manner, and you have to adjust the numbers or figure out a way to make it work based on that. So that is why Yom HaKippurim is such a special day, and the women would go out and dance and try to attract the attention of the men. They just sayanecha, look at the beauty of the woman, and then the Mishnah continues to describe what they used to say, what they used to encourage the men in terms of taking a shidduch, which is interesting to us. It would be completely inappropriate or unacceptable that they were looking into shidduchim on Yom HaKippurim and dancing. But on the other hand, there is something to be said for it. It's a day of Tara, it's a day where people shed all their externalities, and therefore maybe it's the time when people are purest and can make the best decision, mitoch tahara, and that's part of why, first of all, the women here are wearing white, and the Ritva claims that's why we wear white on Yom HaKippurim. Part of that is zecher to what the women did over here, this aspect of tahara, and that purity, or looking at things through this prism of the spirituality of Yom HaKippurim, might end up reading better shiduchim than if it's done in the rest of the year. So that's what the Gemara says, I understand Yom Kippur. But 15th of Av, what's so special about the 15th of Av? So now we're going to have answers from numerous Amoraim as to what happened on the 15th of Av. The Rashbam says, not that they're arguing, but that's the Masorah they had from their Rav. If that's the case, they may not even be mutually exclusive. It might be that more than one of them is true. But his list of reasons is going to connect us back to our Gemara. Yom Shehutru Shvatim Lavoze Bazeh. It was the day that the Shvatim were then mutar to remarry or to once again join each other. Maidarush. What was the drusha that they had? Zadavar. That was what we saw yesterday's daf. Zadavar teaches you that only in this generation was it relevant, but in the next generation it was not relevant. That this practice of not allowing a woman who inherited property to marry someone from a different shevet was limited to that generation, but not extended into the next generation. This leads to a number of questions. First of which is, why was there any need for a celebration? It simply was a cutoff. It applied to one generation. It did not apply to the next generation. So why do you have some day all of a sudden that is the cutoff day? It simply had to do with, were you born in the generation of the Midbar? Or were you born in the next generation? If you're born in the generation of the Midbar, you're subject to the ruling. If you're part of those that were Bayaretz, if you're born afterwards, you're not subject to the ruling. So what does the 15th of Av have anything to do with this? The Locha is said in the 40th year. It's relevant to those that are Bayaretz. The next generation, it's not relevant to. So there are those that want to suggest that the rule applied or the rule was in effect until everybody in that generation was no longer relevant to them. So that even though you personally already had children who were in the next generation, the rule was still in effect until everybody from that previous generation was not subject to this rule anymore. That's one way to deal with it. The Rashash, on the other hand, suggests that they made this drusha on the 15th of Av. That this drusha, Zeh Davar, even though it should have pre-existed, it's something that's embedded in the halacha itself. Nevertheless, either they didn't publicize it, or they didn't actively look at the drusha. But on the 15th of Av, they looked into the drusha and they were matir them to marry each other. And they said, this is limited to that generation. It's not applicable to this generation. And that is what the celebration is about. The Marsha points out that the celebration was by the women. Because the limiting factor here was on the women. Men could marry women from any shevet. The problem was for a woman who inherited Yerusha, she could only marry someone in her own shevet. So the expansion of the pool of individuals that were available is why the women were the ones who were celebrating, because they are the ones who were now given the expanded opportunity to marry more people at that time. So that's why the Marsha says that the celebration revolved around the women and the women dancing, because they were the ones now that were the beneficiaries of this change. Now the Rashbam says over here, there were those that claimed, "Be'ishmi fashim yom shutru shvatim sheritu be'av kalu meitei midbar." So some want to suggest that the reason that Tu B'Av was picked is because we're going to see in a second, that was the day that those that were dying in the Midbar stopped. And since that was dawn, that's the day that the Shvatim were mutar. It says, "V'ta'utu bi'adam." It's a complete mistake. "Shelo l'dor ha'midbar ne'amar l'bayaretz." Has nothing to do with the people who were in the Midbar. It has to do with those that are entering Eretz Yisrael. Be'avot Moab, b'sof mem shana. This halacha and this whole din is said in the 40th year to the Bayaretz. It has nothing to do with the people in the Midbar. And the door that we're speaking about here is Dor Bayaretz, not Dor HaMidbar. So those that think that the Tu B'Av here is connected to the next thing that we're going to say in a second about the Dor HaMidbar stopping to die, that is not relevant over here. But rather, that was the day either of the Drusha, that was the time that that generation had stopped being relevant to them, this Halacha. But for whatever reason, Tu B'Av was picked as the date of celebration. Rabba Barachana Amar Rabbi Yochanan Yom Shutar Shevi Binyamin Lavo Bukal. After Hilegesh Begiva, in which the Shara Shvatim had taken a Cherem, which first of all required them all to go to battle, Yavesh Gilad, who does not join in, they kill out because of that Cherem. Yavesh Gilad, who is very sympathetic to Shevi Binyamin, we see that later on in the time of Shaul, where they take care, they're the ones who go back and steal back the bodies of Shaul and Yonatan from the Plishtim, the people of Yavesh Gilad do that. So even though Yavesh Gilad is Beivar Yardain, they were very, very connected to Shevet Binyamin. So when they don't go to battle with the rest of the Shvatim in Pigalei Shbegiva, they get killed out. Then they also took a Cherem, which said that no one was permitted to give their daughters to the Shevet Binyamin. So now we have a problem at the end of Pilegesh Begiva, which is that they nearly have wiped out the entire Shevet Binyamin. They're only, as we saw Previously, there were only 500 men left. They have a sufficient number of women from those that were left from Yavesh Gilad to marry them off. But then that's not enough to cover all those men that were left over. And they need to figure out a way in which the Shevet Binyamin can marry and continue, because otherwise there's going to be a Shevet wiped out from Klal Yisrael. So this is where they were matir their daughters to marry into Shevet Binyamin. Dichtiv. The pasuk says, "V'ish Yisrael nishba b'mitzpeh le'mor, ish mimenu lo yiten bito le'binyamin." So this is part of that shva, that chayrim in the mitzpeh, that no one will give their daughters to Shevet Binyamin le'isha as a wife. My darush, what was the drasha? Mimenu velo mibneinenu. It's from us, we won't give it, but not from our children. Meaning that our sons are not restricted by this shvuah. Again, this is interesting in nature because either the original shvuah did or did not include it. That's number one. Number two is, again, what's the significance of Tu B'Av over here? That might have to do with the time period of the year when they did it. They were dancing in the Kerem, and that's how they set it up, that the Bnei Binyamin could come and snatch a wife, and they weren't giving their daughters to the Bnei Binyamin. The Bnei Binyamin were taking their daughters. So maybe it's associated with that dancing and the celebration of the wine or harvest of the grapes. And so maybe that's why it was associated with Tu B'Av, as well as the fact that if either it's not including the original Shua, then it's only relevant to that generation, not the next. Why do you have a cutoff point? And what's the drasha? So it could be that the drasha went back afterwards and trying to find a way to limit the neder, and that's what was my darush over here. But you have a similar idea here as you had by the Shvatim, and the Marsha says the similar thing over here, that the women are the beneficiaries. Because nobody was restricted from marrying the daughters from Binyamin or the women of Binyamin. The only people that were restricted are women from other Shvatim marrying the men of Binyamin. So again, their pool of individuals was shrunk. So the women are the ones celebrating that the expansion of their ability to now marry into Shevet Binyamin. Right? Rav Dimi bar Yosef Amar Rav Nachman, Yom Shukalu Bo Meitei Midbar. The day on which those that were dying in the Midbar stopped dying. The Rishbam brings the Midrash that Rashi quotes on Chumash, which is that in every year they used to dig their graves, lay down in their graves, and then they used to say, Kumo Achayim Mitoch HaMeitim, those that are still alive should get up, those that passed away, those were their graves, and they would pass away. And this happened on Tisha B'Av of every year in the Midbar. On the final year in the Midbar, they went and lay down, and then in the morning they got up and nobody was dead. Everybody got up. So they were a little confused as to why nobody had died. And so then they said, maybe we got the date wrong. So they kept trying it until Tu B'Av, the middle of the month, because then there's a full moon. And they knew for sure that they hadn't missed the date, and that's what caused the celebration at that time. That's the Rashbam's explanation, as well as Rashi's explanation. The Bali Tosafot are, as you can see here, very bothered by this explanation for a number of reasons, including which then the people of the Midbar did not pass away. The way that the Midrash states it is that there were 15,000 or so people that passed away each year in the Midbar. And if you don't have them die in the 40th year, then there are 15,000 or so people that survive the decree of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to die in the Midbar. And how could it be that they didn't die in the Midbar? It says in the count, the enumeration of the census in Pinchas, that nobody in the census in Pinchas was in the census of Moshe Va'aron at the beginning of Bamidbar. They're saying explicitly that anybody from that door passed away already. But here you don't. You have people who did survive it. So Tosfot comes up with all different reasons. As near the Beinu Town, if you midrash eicha, shalom mi'aru l'mut, ela b'shachan achrona bitel me'em egzera, v'nisharu me'em ted vavelef uprutot utan she'iruim l'mut b'shana achrona. The Beinu Town says that it was a forgiveness that was granted. It was a waiver that was granted those individuals in the final year. Then he has to deal with the pasuk in Parashat Pinchas. So the Bali Tosfot either say that the people in the final year were not exactly 20 yet when the decree happened in the Midbar. They were a little before 20. And the question was, were those people included in the Gzera? Not included in Gzera, they weren't sure. In the end, they were forgiven or they were released from the Gzera. So they were technically under 20 at the time of the Gzera, even though they were almost 20. Or maybe 20 only counts when you have 20 years and 1 month, because then it's considered to be a full 20 years. Can they come up with different ways to explain it or deal with it? And then the Bali Tosafot also lean heavily back on what they said before, which is that When it says that those people died out, it says those people that were supposed to die out, died out. Doesn't mean that there was nobody left from the first time to the last time. It means that anybody who was subject to the decree passed away. Just like the Baal Tosfot said before, people over the age of 60 who were not necessarily subject to the decree, that means that they could have been in the second census as well, because they, even though they were in the first census, they weren't subject to the decree of the Meraglim. So even though the second census says nobody from the first census is there, means nobody who was subject to the decree. That's what the Baal Tosfot suggests again over here, that they weren't under the original decree, and therefore they're not subject to that pasuk. The other possibility is what the Baal Tosfot bring over here, that every time on Tisha B'Av, they used to pass away. And after that, they would have the period of Avelut for those that passed away. Well, if you have someone that passes away on Tisha B'Av, then if you have Mixat Yom Kekulu like we have by Avelut, then on Tu B'Av, you'd be done with Avelut. And so therefore, the Yom Shekalu Bo Meitei Midbar is not the end of those that died in the Midbar, but rather that year was special because of the fact that this was the final time that they had this Shiva or this Avelut, and this was the end of the Avelut for those that passed away in the Midbar. And so, since the Shechina is not Shoreb Atzvut, it's not Shoreb when people are upset or when people are despondent, then they have to wait for the clearing of the Avelut in order for the Shechina to be Shoreb, and that'll connect it to the next statement in the Gemara as to what happened on Tu B'Av. But for that reason, the end of that Atzvut, the end of that period of mourning for the decree of the Midbar, finally ended on Tu B'Av of that 40th year. Right? That's the way the Baal Tosafot deal with it. There are other issues that are irrespective of which explanation you give. One of the most important, which is a problem in general, that the Chet HaMeraglim only takes place in the second year in the Midbar, and the Gzeira is for 40 years, and the numbers being described here are based on a 40-year distribution, which seems to indicate that their punishment already started before the Chet HaMeraglim happened. That's a more generic question that has to be dealt with irrespective of how you explain it, irrespective of all of these midrashim over here. But all of these questions lead the Baal Tosafot to not accept what the Rishbam is saying, but come up with other possibilities as to what happened on Tu B'Av in the Midbar. Damamar, because Achlo Kalu Mete Midbar, until all those that passed away in the Midbar had been finished off, Lo Yadiburim Moshe, Hashem did not speak to Moshe. Shenemar, because it says in the Pasuk in Dvarim, Vayi Kashir Tamu Kol Anshei HaMilchama Lamot Mikerav Am. Once all those people, the soldiers of the Am, passed away, V'samichlein, right afterwards it says, V'yidaber Hashem Eli Lemor. Eli Hayai Dibur. Finally, there was a Dibur, there was something said to me. So now, there are a number of ways to learn this. The Rashbam himself already brings two possibilities of what it means. Does it mean that Hashem really didn't speak to Moshe for the 38 years that were there in the Midbar? It's distinctly possible because you have a absence of a Kodesh Baruch Hu for those 38 years because they're not mentioned in the Torah. Sefer Bamidbar, in the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar, ends with the story of the Meraglim, which is in the second year, and then it picks up in Parshat Chukat in the 40th year of the Midbar. So there are 38 years missing, with the exception of Adat Korach. Adat Korach, where it falls out, whether it was sometime immediately or close to after the Meraglim, according to Ibn Ezra, before the Meraglim, that's the one thing possible exception to that rule. But otherwise, the Torah doesn't mention Hashem speaking to Moshe during that period of time. So we don't know if Hashem spoke to Moshe during that time. So the Rashbam brings one possibility that literally Hashem did not communicate with Moshe during those 38 years. And now he's speaking to him again. That's one possibility. The other possible explanation is that Hashem had a special relationship with Moshe where he spoke to him panim al panim. That relationship of speaking to panim al panim was suspended during that 38 period, and he would only speak to him ayyidei malach or urim betumim, or the way that other nevi'im got their nevuah, not the special way that Moshe was used to. And then here it returned by the very light. Hashem spoke to me directly, meaning that it was once again panim el panim. So those are two possible explanations. Either that during that period of time, Hashem didn't speak to Moshe whatsoever, or the possibility that Moshe communicated with God, but the way of a derech of a regular Navi, not the panim el panim that he had before. That's the other possibility. You could also argue that the difference is that during the time period of the 38 years, Moshe could only speak to Hashem when it was absolutely necessary, meaning when Hashem approached him and was addressing a specific issue. Before the 38, and after the 38 years, Moshe could approach Hashem, and he could initiate the conversation or initiate the question. So that's another way you could distinguish. Seemingly, the proof is the fact that it says, after, kashir tamu klanshem milchamalamut, mikervam, and then vayidaber Hashem elai lemor. So then Hashem began to speak to me, panim el panim, he began to communicate with me again, if you believe there was no communication, and it's connected to the Meitei HaMidbar being wiped out. Also, the Rashbam says over here that the next parshia over there says, Vayomer Hashem Elai al tatzaret Moav. He says that right afterwards it says Vayomer. And that contrasted with Vayidaber tells you that this Vayidaber was unusual, was a more personal and direct conversation that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was having with Moshe Rabbeinu. So then that communication that comes right afterwards is telling you that Hashem started to re-communicate with Moshe. And this goes back to that previous explanation as to what the Simcha and Tu B'Av is. Is it because they stopped dying and therefore there is now Hashem begins to communicate with them and they're B'Simcha? Or like the Rabbi Tosafot suggested that the Avelut, for those that died in that 40th year, was over then. And now the whole decree of the Midbar had been lifted and the Avelut had been lifted. And it was a Simcha then on Tu B'Av where Hashem could start communicating with Moshe again. Because that despondency from the whole decree now lifted with the finality or the finishing of the Avelut for that last year in the Midbar. And that all took place on Tu B'Av. Ula Amar, Yom Shebitel Bo Hoshea Ben Elah, Pardese Ot, or the other Girsa is Pruzda Ot, or there's another Girsa of Parsada Ot, which generally is meant to mean guards that blocked the roads from the northern kingdom to the southern kingdom. Shoshiv Yeravam ala drachim shlo ya Yisrael aregel. Once Yeravam ben Nevat split away Malchut Yisrael and put up the Agalim in Beit El in Dan, it's never explicitly mentioned in the Navi, but the Gemara assumes because of the purpose of the Agalim, which he explicitly says was to prevent Bnei Yisrael from having to go down to Yudah to have their religious fulfillment and keep them in the northern kingdom. So the assumption was that he also put up guards on the way to prevent people from being Ola the Regel. So the Gemara is Middayek by Hoshea ben Elah that it says over there that he did that which was wrong in the eyes of Hashem, but not like those kings that came before him. And all the kings that came before him, it says, even if they were good or bad, they all say that they didn't remove the Agalim of Yeravam ben Nevat. So that's like the basic thing that none of the kings of Israel ever did, and they exist throughout the kingdom of Israel, are these Agalim. Instead of saying, Vayelech b'derech Yeravam ben Nevat, ubechatato asher echti et Yisrael, by Hoshea ben Elah, it doesn't mention that, it just says, lo kareh malchei Yisrael asher ulefanav. He didn't do the right, but he wasn't as bad as all those before him. And so Gemara is medayek from that. It doesn't mention about Yeravam ben Nevat, that he changed that. He removed the guards from the road, and by removing the guards from the road, he now allowed Bnei Yisrael to return to the Mikdash or be Ola Lerego. The only little problem with that is that Hoshea ben Elah is the last king of the northern kingdom. He's the last king of Israel. He is conquered by Yeshua at that time, and the Galut of the Aseret Shevatim happens under his rule. As Chazal connected to this incident. Because even after he had removed the guards, the Ten Shevatim don't go on Aliyah Lerego. So they condemn the Ten Shvatim to the penalty of Galut is because even after Hoshea ben Elah removed the impediment to them getting to Yerushalayim, they don't go up to Yerushalayim. Truth is, it's been so many hundreds of years that they had never gone, they may not even known that there was any mitzvah to go up to Yerushalayim. The Marsha points out that it is a little bit of a mixed blessing, because even though he removed them on that day and that was for celebration, nevertheless, people don't take advantage of it. And that leads to the Galut of the Aseret HaShvatim and Hoshea ben Elah being the final king of Israel. It was the day on which the massacre in Beitar, that the dead that were laying there in Beitar were allowed to be buried. The day on which those that were killed or massacred in Beitar were allowed to be buried, they instituted the bracha, the additional bracha that we have in benching, of Tova Meitiv. A Tov Shlo Yisrichu. The Tov was thanking Hashem that the bodies did not decompose. Va'meitiv Shenatnu Lekvura. And that Hashem was good and allowed them to be buried in a proper manner. The massacre of Beitar is one of the things that we discuss on Tisha B'Av, one of the reasons that we fast on Tisha B'Av. It was a closure to the period of the Bar Kokhba revolts in the time of Rabbi Akiva, where the Romans wipe out the city completely. The Midrashei Chazal speak about the number of killed and being so extreme and the blood flowing was so great that it was a massacre of unprecedented proportions. But importantly, the general, the Caesar at the time, did not allow them to bury the dead in order to demonstrate or to tell them that this is not going to happen again. You're going to leave this sign that you guys are not going to rebel anymore, that the rebellion is totally quelled. And if you start up with us, this is what's going to happen to you. So finally, at some point, they allow them to bury the dead. And the bracha b'tov meitiv, which is the fourth bracha in Birkat HaMazon, is a bracha that's added midrabanan. That's the reason that when we say bonei b'rachamav Yerushalayim amein, we put an amein over there to distinguish between the first three brachot, which are midoraita, or at least hinted to midoraita, versus the final bracha, which is added in, which is only a bracha midrabanan, which has nafkamina d'alocha in terms of workers and what they need to say. Additionally, the bracha is a tov ve'ameitiv. It's a double tov. One is that the bodies didn't decompose. Second of all, they were given the kfura. Why they put it in benching, their Tosafot in the Gemara and Tanit suggests that the Midrash says that Hadrian took the bodies and piled them up around his vineyard, around his kerem. And so then finally when they were given to burial, they saw a connection between the vineyard and the burial of the bodies. And every benching, when you bench ala kos, you're going to say a bracha bori pri agafen. So because of that bracha bori pri agafen, they connected the bracha v'tova meitiv to bori pri agafen, and that's why they established the bracha in Birkat HaMazon instead of in Shmon Esrei or some other religious ceremony. Right, Rabbi Rav Yosef Damrei Tarayu, Yom Sheposkim Bo Melichot Etzim LaMaracha. It's the last day on which they cut wood for the Maracha. Because Tanya, Rabbi Lezer, Agadol Omer, Kevin, Shigiyah Chamisha Sar Ba'av, once the 15th of Av comes around, Tashash Kocha Shel Chama, the power of the sun has peaked, V'loyu Kortim Etzim LaMaracha, and they no longer cut wood for the Mizbeach. Amrav Menashe Vikarile, and they call that day Yom Tavar Magal, the day of breaking of the axe. I mean, it's the day that they lay the axe down because they no longer are going to cut wood. The reason being is that the wood for the maracha needs to be wood that is completely dried out. It needs to be dried out for two reasons, one of which is if there's any moisture in the wood when you burn it on the maracha, it causes smoke to rise. And they didn't want the mizbeach to have smoke come out of it because of the moisture in the wood. So they wanted absolutely dry wood. The second reason is, you're not allowed to have any worms in the wood. It has to be wood free of worms. The worms can only live in the wood if it's not absolutely dry. There has to be some moisture. And if you completely dry it out, then the worms that live generally between the bark and the wood itself don't have a hospitable place to live, and it will make sure that there are no worms in the wood. For that reason, you have to have the wood dry out. That means you have to have sufficient time from the time that you've cut the wood for it to have the sun be strong enough in order to dry out the wood. If you cut up until Tu B'Av, if you cut, there's still sufficient time in which the wood can dry out and be ready for the Mizbeach. After that point in time, if you cut it, it won't dry out sufficiently to be used on the Mizbeach. And that's why it's the cutoff point for cutting the wood of the Mizbeach. It might be similar in the opposite fashion to Tu B'Shvat. In the calendar, they're 6 months apart, which is Tu B'Shvat, we say, has that aspect with regards to the rain or the moisture, which is that is the peak or the Rov HaGeshamim are done by Tu B'Shvat. That's why it's Rosh Hashanah the Ilanot. So on the other side here, you have Tu B'Av, which is the dryness or the peak of the dryness season. And after that, it starts to diminish, and therefore you can't cut wood from that point forward because it's not going to be dry enough for the Mizbeach. So now, what's the Simcha? Mikan Ve'elech, from that day forward, the Mosif Yosif, the one who adds on will be added on, Sheino Mosif, and the one who does not add on, Yosif, will be something. We don't know what the word means. Over here, the Rashbam says, if you told me, Yaseif, if you told me that's what would happen to him, then we know that Yaseif, or Me'aseif, is a Lashon of Mitah, he will die. The word Yaseif is somewhat ambiguous or unclear as what it means. So my Yaseif, Tani Rabbi Yosef Tikbirei Imei, that his mother will bury him. So first of all, the language here that is mentioned is also mentioned in the Mishnah Avot in a similar fashion. And that is in the first paragraph in the Mishnah Avot, it says, Hillel Omer, and he says, Negid Shema Avad Shemei, Udala Mosif Yasef, Udala Yif Ketala Chayav, Udevish Tomeish Betaga Chalach. So he says the same expression, Dolo Mosif, the one who does not add on, Yasef, will be, here it says, die, or his days will be cut short. What is it referring to here in terms of Mosif? So the Rashbam says that someone needs to add on, min alayla alayom lishnot, yosif yamim. The person who extends his learning into the nighttime. Because the days are starting to descend in terms of daylight hours. Because of that, you need to add on more time from the night in order to make up for the learning lost during the day. So as the nights are getting longer, we don't want you sleeping more because the nights are getting longer. We want you learning at night also to compensate for the lack of daylight hours when you can learn. So that's what it says here. The one who is mosif, the one who is adding on from the nighttime hours, yasif, he'll be rewarded, he will have extended days. The lo mosif, the one who doesn't do that and goes to sleep, yasif, his mother will bury him or his days will be shortened. And in essence it is midah keneged midah. If you don't add on to the learning at night, then Hashem is going to diminish your days. You want to sleep more at night? Hashem says, I'll give you a long time to sleep, and you'll be in the grave sleeping. So that's the midah keneged midah. It's, Marsha points out that it's a little interesting, because wouldn't you have said this starting at Tkufat Tammuz? They should start at the solstice. Starting at the solstice, the days already are starting to shrink. June 21st is the longest day of the year. At that point, it starts to diminish. So why is Tu B'Av a significant day? What you could argue is that the Tu B'Av is the point where it starts to accelerate, meaning that at the peak around the solstice, it moves a small amount. By Tu B'Av already, you start to get a significant movement towards the equinox. And during that period of time, the days are shrinking at a accelerating rate. So maybe that's what is governing it, or that's the time period already when the day is shrinking enough where you start to need to add on from the nighttime hours. Before that, you could get away with just doing the day because the days are so long or long enough that it's not an issue. Only when you get to that point is there a cutoff or a crossover, but it's a little bit difficult to understand why that's connected to Tu B'Av necessarily. What is the reason for the Simcha over here? So the Rashbam says, "Voto yom shepasku ayu smechim." The day they stopped cutting the wood, they were happy. "Levish voto yom ayu mashlimim mitzvah gedolah kazot." So they finish a big mitzvah. When you complete a mitzvah, there's a reason for a celebration. So the celebration of Tu B'Av was the completion of the mitzvah. Now, the Rabbeinu Gershom, on the other hand, says that the celebration was "Levisha sheyu uskim lichrot atzei meracha ayu mitbatlim mitalmud Torah." In the time period where they had to chop the wood and they were preparing for the mizbeach, they could learn less. Avaloto yom pasku. On that day they stopped. Vasu yom tov shemikam elech hayu oskim b'torah. From that day forward, they were osek in Torah. And so that was the crossover at that point was from the Tu B'Av. They stopped having to work on the maracha and cutting the wood. And now they had more time for learning Torah. That's according to the Rabbeinu Gershom. The reason is because of the simcha giving up the need for work, and now being free in order to learn. The Rashbam here says it has to do with the fact that they completed a big mitzvah. Again, if you connect between the two, it might be, like the Rabbeinu Gershom says, that the necessity to add on to the learning of Torah was to compensate for the Torah that was missed during that period of time when they were cutting the Eitzim, and that's why you have to start adding on at that period of time in order to compensate for the lack of Talmud Torah that happened during the period of time that they were engaged in cutting the wood for the maracha. Right now, we're going to continue. Tan Rabbanan. Shiva kiplu et kol ha'olam kulo. There are seven people who age or connection will cover the entirety of the existence of the world. The Marsha over here says it's connected to the pasuk, to the seven pillars of the world. Sha'amru b'chagiga. The world stands on seven pillars. That it's established or was quarried with seven pillars. That the world is standing on seven pillars. And that's why the number seven. You could also imagine that the number seven is something that references to Derech HaTeva, for something that's within the normal framework of Teva of the world. And so seven is a representative number of the Olam Hazeh. So here we're going to see whether just seven people, you can cover the whole span of time of the world. And that is because Mitushelach Ra'a Adam. Adam HaRishon, long enough that Mitushelach actually met Adam HaRishon. Shem, the son of Noach, Ra'a Mitushelach. He saw Mitushelach. Again, this comes out of the dating of their lives in Breishit and in Noach. So you know that Mitushelach, based on the Midrash Chazal, passed away right before the Mabul. And Shem, already there, is 98. Yaakov Ra'at Shem. Similarly, we know that Shem and Aver, where Yaakov went to the Beit Midrash of Shem and Aver, that's because if you look at the years of Shem, he lived long enough that he was alive at the time of Yaakov. So all of this is empirical, because you can go into the Psukim in the Torah, see the dates of how long they lived, and you can see the overlap between Adam, Mitushelach, Shem, and Yaakov. Aramram Ra'at Yaakov. At this point, we leave the empirical evidence, and now we move to the Misora, as the Rashbam says. Even though it's not obvious or clear that Amram ever saw Yaakov, but we know that Yaakov descended to Mitzrayim, and so did Levi go down to Mitzrayim. Levi's oldest child is Kehat, and Kehat is also of the Yordei Mitzrayim, and then Amram is Kehat's oldest son. So it would be presumable that if Yaakov lives for another 17 years in Mitzrayim, and Kehat is Yordei Mitzrayim, in all likelihood Kehat had his first child before the passing of Yaakov, and there Yaakov saw Amram. Achia Shiloni ra'at Amram. Achia Shiloni saw Amram, and again, this would be make Achia Shiloni have an extremely long life, because Achia Shiloni appears as a Navi in the time of Yeravam ben Nevat, at the time of the splitting of the kingdom between Yehuda and Israel, in Malachim Aleph, that's where Achia Shiloni shows up, and now we're saying that Achia Shiloni saw Amram. So that means that he saw Amram before he passed away. And then you have, after Amram's passing away, the remainder of the Shibud in Mitzrayim, which the Rashbam calculates as about roughly 56 years. That means that he was 56 years until they leave Mitzrayim, the entire period of the Midbar, and then all the way in the time of Eretz Yisrael, until he gets to the point of time of Yeravam ben Nevat. And then it says also that Eliyahu ra'at Achia Shiloni. Eliyahu overlaps Achia Shiloni. Again, that's not obvious from the Navi. These are all Misorot, because Achia Shiloni appears in the beginning of Melachim Aleph. Eliyahu appears at the latter part of Melachim Aleph. So it would make sense that they overlapped, or they passed the torch one to the other. But again, it's not something that is explicit in the Navi. Vadayin Kayam. And Eliyahu and Navi is still around. And those are the many stories that we find in the Gemara about Eliyahu Navi visiting Tanaim and Amoraim, and that Eliyahu Navi is still alive. That is precipitated by a pasuk that is found in Divrei Yamim that has Eliyahu Navi mentioned many years after he's Histalek LaShemayim in Melachim Bet, when he's Olo LaShemayim, when Elisha takes over for him. We don't see him anymore. He doesn't appear anymore. They actually go to search for him and they can't find him. But many years later, during the time of the kingdom of Yehuda, all of a sudden we have a king who receives a letter from Eliyahu Navi. Well, how do you get a letter from Eliyahu Navi if Eliyahu Navi has passed away? And that leads to the Midrash Chazal that Eliyahu Navi is still alive, Lomet Eliyahu Navi, and he still appears. And therefore Eliyahu Navi then carries the span from himself until today. Eliyahu is the seventh one. And since Eliyahu is Chai V'Kayam, so therefore, I'll wait till today. He'll carry the torch of those that seven individuals who can span the entirety of the existence of the world. Now here, the Rashbam and the Balei Tosafot point out what you are noting, which is that we have other Midrashim that first of all say Pinchas was Eliyahu. So if that's the case, you could have skipped Achia Shiloni, because Pinchas would have bridged between the time of Amram until the time of Eliyahu Navi, because he is Eliyahu Navi. So obviously this Midrash or this Agadah does not subscribe to that position, as well as he speaks about the Midrash Chazal about Chanoch. Chanoch enenu ki lakach oto Elokim. He wasn't around anymore because God took him. So over there again, did he take him because he took him when he was young and he died? Or was he ki lakach oto Elokim? He turned him into Matatron, who's a Malach, would be around, and then you would only need two people. You could have Adam HaRishon and Chanoch, and that would have been sufficient. So the Rashbam and the Balei Tosafot are pointing out over here that this Tana obviously does not subscribe to other Midrashim that would then obviate the need for some of these people because of the Midrashim connecting between Pinchas and Eliyahu, Chanukah and others. And so they just point out that those Midrashim do not square with the Midrash that we have over here. Then others suggest that Matatron and Chanukah is not a question because Matatron is no longer a human being. He's a malach now. If he's a malach, that's not someone who's counted amongst those that are living here. Dalei Tosafot asks from Serach Bat Asher, who lived extremely long life, why isn't she mentioned as one of those bridges? So he says that this Tan obviously does not subscribe to that about Serach Bat Asher, or others suggest that they're not speaking about women, they're only speaking about men, so Serach Bat Asher was not counted. But again, this is a midrash, but this midrash also makes it that you can't subscribe to other midrashim that we know about it. Achia Shiloni lives an extremely long time. That's what I mentioned yesterday. The Ibn Ezra mentions Achia Shiloni as one of those extreme things that comes out of Sidur Olam Rabba that seems to be way out there. How could it be? Why is it possible? And Ibn Ezra rejects it as a dat yachid. But Yosef Chalapta, the author of Sidur Olam Rabba, the same way that he rejected this idea that Yocheved gave birth at Kuflamet at 130 years old, which also derives from Sidur Olam Rabba. So this is that example that we brought yesterday. The Gemara has a problem based on this midrash, which is Achia Shiloni ra'at Amram. How is it possible that Achia Shiloni saw Amram? Aktiv. From those people that were Yotzei Mitzrayim, that were part of the census in the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar, none of them survived except Yoshua ben Nun and Kalev ben Yefuneh. Achia Shiloni, as the Rashbam points out, was a minimum of 50, had to be a minimum of 56 years old in order to have seen Amram. That means that he is within the range of individuals that would have been killed in the Midbar. So Rav Nuna lo nigzag zerah shifto shel Levi. Levi was not under the gzerah of the Chet HaMeraglim and didn't die out in the Midbar. Shedichtev, b'midbar zeh yiplu pigrechem, that you will all die, your corpses will fall in this Midbar. V'chol pigudechem, v'chol misperchem. All those that were enumerated in number, miben esrim shana v'mala, from 20 years and up. Mish pigudah miben esrim, those that are enumerated from 20 years and up, Yatzah Shevet Shel Levi Shepikudav Miben Shloshim. Excepted from that is the Shevet of Levi, whose enumeration is from 30. Now, the Rashbam brings two possibilities. Either 30 means the 30 days, because the Leviim were counted from 30 days and older when they were exchanged with the Bechorim, or it means from 30 years and up, which is the Avoda of the Leviim in the Mishkan, starts from the age of 30, and so they have an enumeration of from 30 years and up, but not 20 years and up. That means that Shevet Levi was not subject to the decree of the Meraglim, and that's why Achia Shiloni was accepted from that decree, and that's why he didn't die in the Midbar. And as the Rashbam points out, Achia Shiloni is assumed to be a Levi because he's mentioned in Divrei Yamim amongst those of the Leviim. Achia is mentioned, not Achia Shiloni, but Achia, and the Gemara associates that Achia with Achia Shiloni. Umishvar Shvatim lo ayil. Is it really true that only Shevet Levi made it through, but none of the other Shvatim had people besides Yeshua ben Nun and Kalev ben Yefuneh who made it into the Eretz from Yotzei Mitzrayim? V'atanya, Ya'ir ben Menashe, U'machir ben Menashe noldu b'mei Yaakov. They were born at the time of Yaakov. Again, it's a Mesorah. Even though the pasuk at the end of Bereishit says, V'ayah Yosef le'Ephraim b'nei Shilashim, gam b'nei Machir ben Menashe yoldu al birkei Yosef. So even the children of Machir ben Menashe were born on the knees of Yosef, meaning that Yosef saw not only his grandchildren, but his great-grandchildren. Here the Gemara is saying, at least the grandchildren of Yosef were also seen by Yaakov Avinu, and not just the great-grandchildren and grandchildren seen by Yosef. V'lo meit to watch Nifnasu Yisrael Aretz, and they didn't pass away until Bnei Yisrael entered into the land, Shenemar. V'yakum em anshei ha'ai kishloshim v'shisha ish. Because Anshei Ai killed around 36 people. So now, when you use a round or an estimate number, you generally use a round number. Over here, you're saying around 36. 36 sounds like an exact number. And so then, why is it saying Kish Loshim V'Shishayish? Like 36 people. Either say 36 people, or say like 40 people, or like 35 people. Round 36 is not a round number. Vatanya, 36 mamash, Divi Rabbi Yehuda. Vida says literally 36 people were killed in the Battle of Ai because of the fact that Achan took from the Cherem in Yericho, and therefore the Bnei Yisrael, who are Arivim Zelizeh, were defeated in the first battle against the Ai, and they lost 36 people. Amar Relo Rabbi Nechemiah, Nechemiah says Rabbi Yehuda, V'chinem Ru 36. Doesn't say 36 in the Pasuk, it says, Alo Noemar, Elakish 36. It says like 36. Elazeh Ya'ir Ben Menasheh, Shishakul Kerubah Shel Sanhedrin. That's Ya'ir Ben Menasheh, who's like the robe of the Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin is 71, so majority is 36. El Amar Avachar Bar Yaakov, Lo Nigzak Zerah, Lo Al Pachot Mi Ben Esrim, Lo Al Yeter Mi Ben Shishim. So this is an important part of the Zerah of the Meitei Midbar, which is that the decree on the Meitei Midbar was only from those from the age of 20 to 60. If you were under the age of 20 or you were over the age of 60, you were not subject to the decree in the Midbar. Lo pachot mi ben esrim dichtei mi ben esrim shana v'malo. Not on those younger than the age of 20, is because it's explicit in the Pasuk that the decree only applies to those over the age of 20. V'lo yeter mi ben shishim, not more than 60. The Pasuk never mentions 60 as a cap. Gamar mi umalo malo mi arachin. It learns out umalo from the word malo by arachin. By arachin, there are different age categories, which we just read in Parshat Bechukotai. When a person promises their erech to the Mikdash, there are these age scales that you look up, and depending on what your age is, you pay out your erech to the Mikdash. So the main scale, the highest cost redemption, is between the ages of 20 and 60. Up to the age of 20 is one price, 20 to 60 is another price, and over the age of 60 is another price. So what they're pointing out is that 20 to 60 is a distinct period of time or a single entity of a person's life. Malalan yeter mi ben shishim kipachot mi ben chaf. Just like by arachin, over 60 is similar to below 20. It's not exact because over 60 you pay less than someone who's less than 20. But the point being is that it's differentiated from 20 to 60. 20 to 60 is the highest price. Under 20 is less than that, and over 60 is also less than that. Afkan, so too by the enumeration of those that are going to be killed in the Midbar, yeter mi ben shishim kipachot mi ben esrim. Over 60 will have the same rule as below 20. That means that those that were over the age of 60 did not pass away or were not killed in the Midbar because of the Chet HaMiraglim. And Yair ben Menashe and Machir ben Menashe, who were born and saw Yaakov Avinu, clearly were over the age of 60. And therefore they're not subject to the decree of the Miraglim. This actually dovetails with the Tosafot before Kuf Yud Zayin Amud Bet, where he argued on the Rashbam, on the opinion of Rabbi Shimon Elazar, who says that there were people who took portions in both the census in Bamidbar and the census in Pinchas, both from those that were Yotzei Mitzrayim and Baye Aretz. Rashbam said it had to be two people, because otherwise they would have died in the Midbar. Over there, the Tosafot says, no, it could be one person, like Machir ben Menashe and Ya'ir ben Menashe, because even though the decree of the Meraglim only applied from 20 to 60, the rights to inherit the land and be a part of the census even went above 60. So if you're over the age of 60, you still got a chelik in the Aretz, as Yotzei Mitzrayim, even though you're not subject to the decree of Meitei Midbar. And in that way, people like Ya'ir ben Menashe and Machir ben Menashe were able to collect both as a Yotzei Mitzrayim and a Baye Aretz, according to Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. So that's how Tosafot dealt with the issue, based on what the Gemara is saying over here, in terms of the cap of 20 to 60. That cap of 20 to 60 was only as far as the decree of the Meitei Midbar, but not as far as a limitation for those that inherited the land. And therefore, they could be included in the census in Bamidbar, as well as the census in Pinchas, even though they were not subject to the decree of the Meraglim. And that's what meant by the Pasuk in Pinchas that says nobody remained from the first census to the second census. Doesn't mean nobody at all. It means nobody who was subject to the decree of the Midbar between the ages of 20 and 60 survived from the first census to the second census, with the exception of Kalev ben Yefuneh and Yoshua ben Nun. Okay, we're going to stop here. Two lines from the bottom of Kuf Chaf Aleph Amud Bet.